Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawain, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into the archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. On today's show, we're going to listen to some of Marty's interviews with 2015 National Humanities Medal Award winners who were honored by President Obama in a ceremony held at the White House Thursday. We'll hear from author James McBride, who's written several books, including the National Book Award-winning novel, The Good Lord Bird. We'll also listen to Marty's interview with our own Terry Gross. The two talked about radio, interviewing, and her circuitous route to being one of public radio's premier personalities. But first, Marty talks with jazz musician, composer, and educator Wynton Marsalis. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. Welcome to Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawain. Thanks for joining us today. Thursday, President Barack Obama bestowed the annual National Endowment for the Humanities Medal to 12 recipients in the East Room of the White House. Today, we're going to play back some of Marty's interviews with three of those honorees. Later in the hour, we'll hear from author James McBride and WHYY's own Terry Gross, host of Fresh Air. But we'll begin with jazz musician, composer, and educator Wynton Marsalis. He received the award for, quote, celebrating the traditions of jazz music from New Orleans to the Lincoln Center and beyond, end quote. He joined Marty back in 2001 when his book, To a Young Jazz Musician, Letters from the Road, was published. Let's listen.
Well, you talk in this book, Wynton Marsalis, about playing the trumpet. It's a powerful instrument. You can never force the trumpet. You got to baby it, treat it, gently coax it. It's always there for you. You just talk about sort of how unforgiving the trumpet can be. How did you end up with this instrument? I know you were pretty little when you started.
Well, my father played with Al Hurt. And Al Hurt is a great New Orleans trumpet player. And when I was for my sixth birthday, he got a trumpet for me. And that's what I had, so that's what I played. And the trumpet is a very powerful instrument. So a lot of times with powerful things, you feel like you have to come with force. And you do have to have some force, but you have to be gentle to get it to do what you want it to do. It's kind of like dealing with big people. Like if you teach kids a lot, some of the biggest, most menacing type of kids or students that you have to deal with, you have the feeling you have to, because they can be imposing with their attitude, you have the feeling you have to be forceful with them, but you don't really. You know, you can almost baby them, and you bring them into another feeling. You know, it's the only way I can describe it.
Really. Well, and this sort of really underscores what you said. The trumpet is an unforgiving instrument, cold metal on skin and lips, straining muscle pressed against teeth. You have to want to play it and keep on wanting it. You won't ever master it. Only work with it. Try to make it an extension of yourself. I mean, do you feel, in all these years, that you're still sort of at the mercy of this instrument?
Oh, we all feel that.
Yeah.
You never know when it's going to come up and bite you. It's a very difficult instrument to play. Mm. It's cold. It's cold-blooded. You have to stay on. If you don't practice it, you get tired very easily. I mean, because it's a very physical instrument.
So you have to be physically in shape to be able to play the trumpet.
Your lips have to be in shape and you're breathing. And if you have to play a long time, your lips will really, really get tired. So it's really the feeling of doing push-ups. When you get to your limit and your arms just start to tremble and stuff, your lips will do that to you. It's the muscle that goes around your mouth is the one that you use. It's called orbicularis. And it'll call you. It'll call your name out.
And I'm thinking, I'm always interested in sort of that creative process, and certainly with composing. Are your ears sort of always open? Are you making mental notes? Are you making, you know, physical notes about things that you hear?
Yeah, you've heard so much in your life. Your sense of hearing is so important to just taking in how you take things in and people's voices, the pace of things. Like that piece of train, I grew up down the street from the railroad track in Kenner, Louisiana. And the railroad track was a dividing line between the black side and the white side. But more than that, the train symbolized freedom. Even if you didn't think about it in that way, it just was always this thing that would come and then it would go. In a piece like that, I'll go from that train to the sound of something that I heard a great drummer, James Black, like his kind of melodies that he liked to write. And you have the whole field of music. It could be Bach's music or Beethoven or early French music, or it could be Jelly Roll Martin's music, or, and you're playing around with all these different elements and sounds of people's voices. And I mean, music is such a wonderful
art,
a wonderful art form.
You compose at a piano? Is that where you do your work?
I compose at a piano. Sometimes if I don't have a piano, then I work the themes out. Idea will come to me or something. I write the music down on whatever is there.
Well, I'm thinking, too, about with the Ken Burns jazz, and you were very much, Wynton Marsalis, a part of that, describing jazz and the artists and the music and all the history there. And again, you know, the sort of pro-con Wynton Marsalis critiques were out there.
Right. That's partially an example, because it was Ken Burns' work. And the whole kind of thing of I led him astray and all that. He had 80 people or 90 people working on the film with him. And it's not so much of me being defensive, but because that's a part of being out here, a criticism, or saying that you should not be critiqued. Being criticized is part of what makes it fun. It's like a game, and the fact that you can lose the game makes it more fun.
Hmm.
And it's like what makes life sweet is the fact that you know you're going to die. Criticism is a part of it, but the thing that the important thing for me for the book was accuracy, was that we were out here, we did do this. Accuracy is always... It's important for us to have a document that's accurate about that particular time.
But do you think if you were, you know, quote unquote, more avant-garde and less popular, that you would get less critique?
Not necessarily. It doesn't make a difference of avant-garde, or those are just terms. It's more a question of whether you have a suit on, or it's status quo thinking, basically. If you think like the status quo, put a funk beat on your music, play some minor major scales and say it's world music, get some naked women out behind you, cuss a few times, put some gold in your mouth, be a minstrel, you got a niche that you can find. If you want to present yourself responsibly and you have comments on things and you have a biting commentary and you don't hold your tongue, you got to be ready for what comes.
Mm.
And if you don't want to accept what comes, then you get in your place, boy. So that's the vibration that's actually out here.
Well, I read a quote from Miles Davis saying to you, "So you're the police, huh?"
That's what he said when I first met him.
Yeah, I mean, this was many years ago, but that's how I guess what he saw you.
Well, I mean, I don't know how, because I was 19 then. I hadn't really had a track record of saying anything. I guess he had a feeling that it was so abstract. I didn't know what he was talking about at first. I had to ask Herbie, man, what is he? I know I heard he was crazy, but damn. And I guess he could just feel a certain energy. Yeah. I was country. I mean, I had on a three-piece polyester gray suit with a derby on. So
you do talk in this book a little bit, Wynton Marsalis, about growing up and your musical family, four of the six kids in the music biz, so to speak. What do the other two do?
Well, one of my brothers is autistic, so he can't talk, and he's severely autistic, so he's not like a savant who can be attracted to music or numbers or something. He's just really trying to just deal with that's a difficult thing to deal with. Autism is such a strange, they live in a certain type of world that there's no real connection with you. And I have another little brother that's in a computer, works with computers, engineering computers.
And your dad, Ellis Marsalis, well-known performer, teacher. Right. What did he teach you about music and the trumpet and playing, performing, conducting?
Well, he taught me about the value of integrity. That's really.
What does that mean, though?
Just the value of having integrity. That you can used to say, those who play for applause, that's all they get. And he had integrity. I never heard my father condescend to people. I never heard him complain. I never heard him reduce people because of their race. I never saw him sink below himself. I never saw him try to act like a child after he became a man. When all the fads and styles changed and came in, you didn't see him trying to imitate you. He just always had the upper ground. He held the upper ground. No matter what kind of gig I saw him on, if there were people, if there weren't people. So when I see my daddy play gigs with 10 people, you know. My brother and I, we're playing in our funk band. Man, we'd have thousands of people dancing our music. He'd be playing a gig with 15 people, 10 people. We'd be making more money than him on some gigs. None of that made a difference to him. He was, I can play and y'all can't. Practice.
Although, interestingly, your mom really didn't want you, I guess, and your other siblings to get into the music biz. She saw how hard it was, especially with your dad, right?
Right. Because trying to raise a family. Right, he was always struggling, trying to make ends meet like a local jazz musician. Always struggling. And my mom was like, you know, do you want to deal with this? But she was very supportive of musicians and of my father. I remember once we had a meeting in our family when my daddy was going to, he'd run out of gigs. We were really going broke. He was going to drive a cab, so. We're like, well, he was saying what we need to do and what's going to happen. And my mama, at that time, she stood behind him. And she was like, no, you know, you're a musician. And it shocked us because she would always be complaining about we didn't have money. And, you know, how was she going to pay for this and how was this? But in that crucial moment, she kind of reaffirmed him in front of all of us. Well, we're going to do whatever we got to do to support you being a musician. That's what you are. And I know Carl's his father was a musician. And I know that they had many musicians. We have a lot in common.
Absolutely.
You know?
So she kept you and your siblings grounded and focused? And
yeah, a lot, because we, you know, our family, we struggled a lot because my father was always trying to work, and but my little brother being autistic, and us, we living in Canada, Louisiana, we didn't know what autism was, and my mama took that very hard.
Yeah.
Like, was it her fault? And, you know, all kind of things that happen in families. A lot of times I talk to people, say, oh, you know, musical family, y'all must be so great. It wasn't like that. It was just people living and struggling with life and, you know, trying to deal with what, which, yeah, my mother and father dealing with their different things that they had to deal with. But my mother was also had a tremendous, a lot of integrity and intelligence and the ability to grasp and solve very complex problems and an acute understanding of American culture and of people and what was going on, a very acute sense she had. And she just really wasn't for any BS, not at all. Like, that's just not where she was coming from.
And I was interested, actually, in reading when Marcel said that sort of moment before going on, before performing, you don't like to, it sounds like you don't like to get to a place real early and hang around. It's like you kind of like to sort of breeze in and go right up on stage. How come?
I like for just to be a part of what's going on and has been going on. And to train yourself to deal with a moment as it unfolds and not what you want it to be. Right. That's another hard thing about jazz. And it's tied in with what you're saying about Ken Burns special. Somebody sit down and watch 19 hours or something of work, and then start saying what they wanted it to be. Well, it's always easy to find what something is not. Like, you come to your house and eat a banquet. It's a banquet laid out of food for me, and I say, you know, but they didn't have gumbo.
Hmm.
You know, they didn't have gumbo, but we had 18 other courses. So people are not known for what they didn't do. They're known for what they did do.
Something you just said reminded me of something that you say in this book, which is about how jazz is dangerous, and that we sort of live our life thinking we're in control of everything, and I guess jazz is a reminder that we're not, right? And sort of celebrates that we're not.
Jazz teaches us to be in time, right. And in time means you think what you think, I think what I think, and we all try to come together with some kind of version of what we're doing as a part of what's going on, and we have to know. We're constantly balancing and negotiating and trying to understand, and that's all we're doing. Even dictators and the fascists, and they couldn't control the people enough to keep them from thinking and doing and overthrowing. You can't do it, no matter how afraid you are of other people. You can't deny them. It most commonly plays out with people in their families, like a husband and a wife, or really with parents and their kids. No matter what, you can't make them be what you want them to be. They have their own path and their own vector, and you can help them and assist them and give them guidance. But whether they choose to take it or not, that's entirely up to them.
And we close out Marty's 2001 interview with jazz musician Wynton Marsalis with Invocation and Chant, featuring Damien Sneed and Chorale Le Chateau from his latest album, The Abyssinian Mass. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from WHYY's own Terry Gross, host of Fresh Air. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks again for joining us today. We're playing archival interviews with some of the recipients of the National Humanities Medals, which were awarded in a ceremony held at the White House Thursday. And we here at WHYY were thrilled to find out that Fresh Air host Terry Gross would be honored with one of these awards. The National Endowment for the Humanities gave her the award for, quote, her artful probing of the human experience, end quote. She's been the host of Fresh Air since 1975, which has grown to become one of National Public Radio's most celebrated programs. She joined Marty back in 2004 when her book, All I Did Was Ask, was published. Let's take a listen.
You've interviewed so many people. You do reveal parts of yourself from time to time, but a lot of people, most people, don't know very much about you. I would even say that's probably true for a lot of people that work here at the station. Our paths cross, but we don't spend a lot of intimate time in conversation. And I know that, and this is just conversations I've had with people, people want to know who you are, what you're like. Do you understand that?
Do you like that? Well, you know, I have mixed feelings about being, talking about my life. On the one hand, I really appreciate it when my guests are really open about their lives. And I interview a lot of guests who say, you know, my life is an open book. You can ask me anything. And in fact, a lot of artists use their own lives as like a case study in what it's like to be human. And in writing about the human condition, their textbook is their own experiences. And so in revealing their own life, they tell us something about our lives. But at the same time, for myself, as someone who's on the air all of the time and who's interviewing not only artists but also people in politics, people involved with issues, my instinct, particularly on the air, is to not reveal much about myself because in some ways I want to be like the engaged person, engaged with the arts. But when it comes to the issue and the political interviews, I want to be a neutral person who is asking often tough questions but out of a position of wanting to find the truth, not of pursuing an agenda. So that's part of the reason why I haven't talked a lot about myself. And I tend to be a private person, but honestly, go ahead and ask me things.
Well, and I will, but in the book you also, you do describe yourself as a shy person, a private person.
Right.
And yet it's so interesting because you're working in this very public medium.
How public is it really, though, in some ways?
Well,
you know, it's invisible.
It is.
Which is wonderful. I feel very comfortable in an invisible world. And I'm mostly asking the questions. Mm-hmm. I'm making other people visible and using whatever knowledge and curiosity I have to help frame their life, to help investigate the truth in an issue-related story, to help tell a historical story. That is, to help the guest tell the historical story. But I'm more of like the framer, the investigator, the curious person. I'm not the one holding forth.
Well, and you also say in this book, and I've heard you say in other contexts, that you in many ways prefer to have a guest not with you in the studio. It's not 100% that way, but and it has certainly ended up that way in Fresh Air, that a guest will be in a studio in another city and you'll be here asking the questions. Is that also part of the invisibility of radio that you like and enjoy and work to your advantage?
Well, when things go really well, I'd like to think that the long-distance nature of it helps because it's pure radio. I can't like nod or smile to the guest and think, well, now they get what I'm thinking. If I'm thinking something that I want them to know, whether it's, ha-ha, that was a funny joke, or, wow, I'm really moved by what you said, it has to come out in the words I use or the tone of my voice. And that makes for better radio. Mm-hmm. Likewise, for anything they say, they have to convey it through their voice, which is good. The other thing I like about the long-distance nature of it is that you're not doing the literal hostessing part of the hosting, you know, calling the cab and, you know, making the arrangements and, you know, getting the coffee. And I mean,
although you do have staff to do that.
Right. That wouldn't necessarily fall to me personally. But it's nice that that's something we don't have to worry about.
Right. Well, is it also
that sounds horrible, doesn't it?
Well, not necessarily horrible. It's interesting, though. But do you also feel like when the interview is on, you don't want to play hostess or you want to be able to think and hear about what the guest is saying without being distracted by their expressions or their body language or the things that happens in an in-studio interview.
Well, the truth is that sometimes it is distracting to be in the same room with somebody. You know, like when I interviewed Nancy Reagan long distance, I thought, it's really good this wasn't in person because this was shortly after she and her husband had left the White House. And I felt the need to ask her challenging questions, which I did. And she didn't like my questions. If she was sitting across from me, two things would have happened that would have made it more difficult for me to ask the questions I wanted to ask. One is I would have been not starstruck, but just struck by the sense of like, well, she looks really different in person than she does on camera. And the other would be watching her look either vulnerable or angry. I'm a very like empathic person. Mm-hmm. I would have been affected by that. And I don't want to sound cold or cruel, but I was there to ask certain questions that I felt really needed to be asked. And it was easier to ask it, not looking her in the face. I mean, I'm a bit of a coward, I guess. And
really? A coward?
I'm being ironic there, but it's easier to ask the tough questions long distance sometimes because you're just thinking about what is the issue I really need to get to as opposed to is the person getting angry with me and are they staring at me to make me back down? I don't have to worry about that.
I got you. You know, we spent a fair amount of time listening to some old tapes of Fresh Air just to get a sense what you sounded like 25 years ago. I see a slight moan and groan coming from you about this, but it is so interesting about how different your voice is. I don't think anyone should be surprised about that. But is that something that you have worked on to create the kind of authoritative voice that you have today?
Well, I don't consider my voice authoritative.
No.
No. First of all, I'm not the expert. And I mean, I do my research. From my point of view, hearing my voice, it doesn't sound to me authoritative. It sounds just like a person's voice. Mm-hmm. When I started in radio, when I get nervous, my voice raises about an octave.
Is that right?
Yeah. I once remember...
She's keeping it nice and low
I once
now.
Got the lead in a part in a summer camp production. And I thought I did good in the audition, and I thought I did good during the rehearsals. When I got on stage, it was kind of like this. You know, when people were coming up to me after the production and saying, I didn't know you had such a high voice. And it's like, well, I don't. But I was really nervous out there. But anyway, so when I started in radio, I was nervous, and my voice raised probably about an octave. And I talk very fast. I'm from Brooklyn. So I think I sounded like a hyperactive Minnie Mouse hosting a feminist program.
Which is not a stereotype you want to play too hard, right?
Right. And as time went on and I listened to myself, I realized, well, I have to slow down. I have to breathe. You make adjustments hearing how you sound, which isn't to say that I think how I sound on the air is phony compared to how I first sounded. I think it's about just like growing and maturing.
And again, I don't want to make too much of this, but you have sometimes described yourself as smaller than life.
Yes.
And do you think it's a disadvantage to be smaller than most people?
Well, it certainly isn't on radio. I've become more aware of it somehow later in life, and I don't know why that is. I was never really particularly self-conscious about being short, and I was always like when there was a lineup in class, I was the one. If I wasn't first, I was second or third. So I was always in front. That always affected like where I sat in class and all of that. And it just didn't matter to me at all.
You know, I'm curious. I was thinking about you as I was putting this show together, and I was trying to imagine what you were like as a 6 or 7 year old. And I'm just curious. You grew up. You had lived in an apartment house. You grew up in Brooklyn.
Yeah. No, I moved to the apartment building at about the age of 6.
Yeah.
We lived in a walk up before that. Well, when I was 6, I think I was probably pretty shy. I was a pretty quiet kid, and I just moved into this brand new apartment building in Brooklyn that was on land that had been part farmland and I think part racetrack. Brooklyn was really changing. I grew up in a very Jewish middle-class neighborhood. I used to feel sorry for the Catholic family across the street.
Lone Catholic family?
I thought that the families that weren't Jewish were part of an embattled minority group.
But did you play with dolls? Did you read? Did you ride bikes? I'm just trying to imagine.
I rode a bike. I had roller skates.
Go ahead.
Well, here's something I shouldn't admit. my best friend and I used to sometimes like roller skate around singing show tunes. It's like, how embarrassing is that?
Well, we all know, though, about your love of music. Did that come from your family? Did you have Lots of that records,
comes from my
music?
Family. Well, my brother was 5 years older than, my brother still is 5 years older than me. And so when I was, I don't know, probably around 8 or 9, and he was 12 or 13, he got what was then a hi-fi.
Ooh.
And so
stack of records.
Stack of records, stack of 45s, and, you know, and LPs. And so when I was really young, I had an older brother who was bringing great records into the house and playing them over and over and over again because he couldn't afford to buy a lot of records, but he had good taste. And so, you know, he was playing like Rumble and the Paragons Meet the Jesters and Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers over and over and over again. And we were both listening to rock and roll radio. So I got hooked on music really young. And my parents listened to WNEW in New York, which a lot of our listeners might know about. At the time, it was the radio station in New York that played a mix of the great stuff, Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, with, you know, Steven Eady and Perry Como and, you know, Patti Page. So you got like the best and, to me, the worst of that form of popular music, which I hated at the time. However, I think that music just kind of seeped into my skin or something, or into my blood, I guess I should say. But now, I mean, I'm just one of Frank Sinatra's greatest fans.
Know.
Ella Fitzgerald. I mean, that's the music that I really love. Of course, I still love rock and roll, and I love a lot of, you know, more contemporary, you know, rock and singer-songwriters and some, you know, some hip-hop and so on. I mean, country music. But I just really love American popular song immensely.
Can you sing? Do you sing at all?
Do I sing at all? That's, believe it or not,
not
a complicated
question.
Not that
I'm going to ask you to sing on Radio Times.
No,
go ahead.
No. I'll be honest with you. At home, I do. In public, absolutely not. I've always been very, not only shy, but embarrassed about that. But I actually enjoy singing in privacy.
And do you use the hairbrush as the microphone?
No. No. No, I don't.
Can I ask you a question or something, and then we'll get back to our callers? This is something that was in the American Journalism Review, actually quoting itself from a previous interview in the American Journalism Review, where you said, "To me, the world is a pretty scary place, fraught with all kinds of dangers, real and imagined." And I wonder if you still feel that way.
Oh, I think the world is a scary place. But I didn't mean that in the sense that I stay home afraid to go out or anything. But I think the world is a scary, unpredictable, chaotic place in many ways. And that's one of the things I love about art. Do you know what I mean? Not that art isn't scary, but art takes out the boring parts of that.
Mm.
art takes the kind of just chaotic, shapeless part of life and gives it shape. It gives it form. It gives it meaning. It gives it direction. It gives it rhythm. It just gives it a shapeliness that real life often doesn't have.
And that's why you like the arts.
I think
just
that's part of the reason. I think art is sometimes, you know, more interesting than parts of life itself.
You spent about 6 weeks as a public school teacher. This was Buffalo an inner city school shortly after graduating from college. Was that what you thought you would be, being a teacher? Is that something at that time, being a woman? I mean, we think of, especially back then, that was more a female profession.
Well, I didn't know what I wanted to be, and I didn't feel called to teach. The only reason why I became a teacher is because, you know, I had spent a lot of my undergraduate years outside the classroom. Like I said earlier, all the action was outside the classroom. It was the anti-war movement, the women's movement, the poetry readings, the concerts. And that's where I spent my time. And suddenly I was about to graduate, and I thought, and what are you going to do? So I figured, well, I'll teach. I mean, I had no idea how to get a job that wasn't the traditional women's professions. You know, when I grew up, all the women I knew who worked, and most of them did not work, but all the women I knew who did work worked in the traditional women's professions, teaching, nursing, or working in their husband's business, clerical work.
Secretarial work.
So I figured, well, okay, I'll get my teaching degree, I'll teach, I'll get my certificate, they'll place me in a class, and poof, I'll be a teacher. And for anyone who's taught, you know, it is not that easy. Teaching is very, very difficult. And I was an eighth grade English teacher in Buffalo, New York's toughest inner city school. And the kids were all taller than I was. They used to, I mean, by the time they placed me, it was the day after Election Day. So the kids were already mobilized, and the the room next door to me was already on their fourth teacher. And it was really hard for me to take control of the class. I'd spent my college years challenging authority, and suddenly I was the authority figure. And I didn't particularly want to be an authority figure. I didn't think of myself as an authority figure. And worse yet, I didn't know how to be one. And I wanted to be the teacher I wanted to have when I was in junior high school. So I used to dress in my purple corduroy jeans. used to rib me. They used to say, "Miss Gross, we saw you at the Salvation Army." Because they thought my clothes looked so cheap and raggedy. And I finally figured out they thought I was disrespecting them by dressing the way I was. So as soon as I figured that out, I ran to the shopping mall and bought like plaid pleated skirts and sweater sets.
Oh, I can't imagine, Terry. But did you go to work with a knot in your stomach, just knowing?
Every day. I would look out the window and I'd look at other people going to work and I'd think, whatever they're doing today, I envy them. I just so much wanted it to end. And when they fired me, I thought, what a blessing, because I wanted to leave. I knew I was too young. I wasn't ready yet to teach, but I didn't want to be a quitter. There was a voice in my head, and I think it was my mother's voice, saying, "You can't be a quitter." So when they showed me the door, it was like, thank you so much. And that's how I stumbled into radio.
Yeah. And as I understand it, by stumbling into radio, you really discovered this thing that you loved.
Oh, it was magic to me.
Instantly.
Instantly. Because I love two things about it. I love doing the interviews, and I love the actual physical magic of it, that you could turn a knob and suddenly a voice would be on the air. And the fact that sometimes it would be my voice, it was just like a miracle. Mm. I mean, I did a lot of engineering back then in my Buffalo days.
Right.
And so I was often the one in the control room turning the knobs and turning the turntable, you know, putting on the turntable. And it was just, I enjoyed that. So it was like a magic act to me.
If you were to start today, do you think you could get into it the way you did and have a show and create this whole fresh air phenomenon?
Well, I couldn't get into it exactly the way I did because I got into it as a volunteer. I had no training. I had no experience. What I had was I really wanted to get into media. I had no idea what I meant by that. Did I mean I wanted to make documentary movies? Did I mean I wanted to produce a TV show? Did I mean I wanted to be on radio? I didn't have a clue. And I probably would have done nothing about it. I was applying to graduate schools in educational media. And all the programs I was getting back, and this was like 1974 or 3, the programs I was getting back, educational media seemed to be how to prepare a slideshow or an overhead projector. And I thought, that's really not what I meant, you know? And I stumbled into public radio through a friend who had a friend that was leaving the feminist show. And she said, "I'm going to give you the phone number of the producer, call her up, maybe that you can work there." And with no skills, with no experience, I was immediately on the air. You can't really do that on the – and that's a good thing for those of us who listen.
You can't do that anymore.
You can't
do
that anymore.
You walk in and get your own show.
No, which is a good thing for listeners, but it's a bad thing for people like me when they're getting started.
That was Marty's 2004 interview with Fresh Air host Terry Gross, who was given a National Humanities Medal at a ceremony held Thursday at the White House. When we get back from the break, we'll hear Marty's interview with author and musician James McBride. Stay with us.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John
Brown's Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We close out our show with winners of the National Humanities Medal by listening to one of Marty's interviews with author and musician James McBride. The National Endowment for the Humanities gave McBride the award for, quote, "humanizing the complexities of discussing race in America," end quote. Marty talked with McBride about his breakthrough work, the novel A Good Lord Bird, which is a reimagining of the John Brown story. Let's take a listen.
Well, I'd love to have you read, I should say, from the very beginning of your new book.
All right. This is from the chapter one titled Meet the Lord. And this is Onion talking. "I was born a colored man, and don't you forget it, but I lived as a colored woman for 17 years. My pa was a full-blooded Negro out of Osawatomie in Kansas Territory, north of Fort Scott near Lawrence. Pa was a barber by trade, though that never gave him full satisfaction. Preaching the gospel was his main line. Pa didn't have a regular church, like the type that don't allow nothing but bingo on Wednesday nights and women sitting around making paper doll cutouts. He saved souls one at a time, cutting hair at Dutch Henry's Tavern, which was tucked at a crossing on the California Trail that runs along the Kaw River in South Kansas Territory. Pa ministered mostly to lowlifes, four-flushers, slaveholders, and drunks who came along the Kansas Trail. He weren't a big man in size, but he dressed big. He favored a top hat, pants that drawed up around his ankles, high-collar shirt, and heeled boots. Most of his clothing was junk he found, or items he stole off dead white folks on the prairie killed off from dropsy or aired out on account of some dispute or other. His shirt had bullet holes in it the size of quarters. His hat was two sizes too small. His trousers come from two different colored pairs sewn together in the middle where the arse met. His hair was nappy enough to strike a match on. Most women wouldn't go near him, including my ma, who closed her eyes in death, bringing me to this life. She was said to be a gentle, high yellow woman. Your ma was the only woman in this world, man enough to hear my holy thoughts, Pa boasted, for I am a man of many parts. Whatever them parts was, they didn't add up to much, for all full up and dressed to the nines, complete with boots and 3-inch top hat, Pa only come out to 4 feet 8 inches tall, and quite a bit of that was air. But what he lacked in size, Pa made up for with his voice. My Pa could out-yell with his voice any white man who ever walked God's green earth, bar none. He had a high, thin voice. When he talked, it sounded like he had a Jew's harp stuck down his throat, for he spoke in pops and bangs and such, which meant speaking with him was a two-for-one deal, being that he cleaned your face and spit-washed it for you at the same time. Make that 3-for-1 when you consider his breath. His breath smelled like hog guts and sawdust, for he worked in a slaughterhouse for many years, so most colored folks avoided him generally.
And that's James McBride reading from the very beginning of his new novel called The Good Lord Bird. And I have to say, when I read that, I was hooked. I mean, I would assume as a novelist, I mean, I don't know how much you intend to hook a reader from the first couple of paragraphs.
I must read
that. Maybe that's your job.
Yeah, I rewrote that first chapter probably at least 30 or 40 times.
Really?
I spent more time on that first chapter than I spent on many sections of the book.
Getting the right words, the right set of music, even.
Well, you're competing with the television and the internet, and I mean, you only have a few seconds for that reader to decide whether or not they're gonna dig in and buy this book. So, once you decide which characters you want to set in place, you want to try to get the rhythm of it. You want to start the song going. You don't have time to do a 4-bar intro. It's right on it. Mm. Raindrops keep falling. you have to do it. Although, I mean, you better not do that these days. But
you just dated yourself. Just
you got to get going though. You have to toss the plane in the air. There's no runway. You have to just shove it in the air and turn on the motor and hope the thing goes.
Well, I love the fact that the Pa, who really can't read, but he quotes from the Bible all the time, including the books of Ezekiel, Ahab, Trotter, and Pontiff the Emperor.
Right, and then and Onion says, I was a full-grown man before I know there weren't no book of Hezekiah in the Bible.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I wanted to introduce the Pa, you know, I wanted the reader to get to know Pa pretty quickly because we don't see him that much after chapter one. But I needed to set up some sort of instance where John Brown walks into a tavern, pulls out his heater, drops the hammer on it, and the thing just goes bad. And so he has to make some decisions about what to do with this little slave child that he sees, and he decides at that moment that this boy who's dressed with and they used to dress slaves with, you know, potato sacks and so forth, just decides that he's a girl and he's coming with him, and off they go.
And he calls him Onion. I mean, Onion is, not to get too deep into the story, but it's kind of a, he sees this boy slash girl as a good luck charm.
As a kind of good luck charm, which is kind of grates against his deep biblical leanings. But, you know, everybody cheats a little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. I drink a little too much coffee. John Brown has a little bit, you know, he has a little good luck charm that he shouldn't. And he falls in love with this kid. And so the kid ends up witnessing and telling the reader what happens. But it's important to remember that this is told from the perspective of an 111-year-old black man who's looking back on his life. So it's told in the sort of voice of those old black characters that mm-hmm. I love to see on the page.
And that's the voice that, I mean, you just read that. That's his voice. The sort of,
yeah, that's Onion talking. That's an old man. You know, the book is set up with there's a fire in a church. They find these papers. some old deacon claims that there was another deacon back in the 40s who, you know, was with John Brown, and they find these papers, and these papers tell this old guy's story.
Do you have members of your family or people who you remember speaking this way?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, my stepfather, my godparents, all my relatives down south. Man, one cousin down south, you need a translator, you know, to talk to him. I love him, you know, but I have to have my little brother with me, so, because my cousin Herbert, I say, he said, "Oh, you're hungry?" And I say, "What did he say?" And he said, "Well, cousin Herbert said you're hungry." "Oh, okay, all right. You want something?" "What did he say?" And he said, "You want something else to eat, or you just want some cornflakes?" So, yeah, I have a lot of old, you know, of my older southern relatives who speak like that. I just love that kind of talk.
Well, do you hear the kind of, I mean, you're a musician, so do you hear the sort of musicality of that kind of talking?
I think what you hear is you hear the straight melody in it, you know. People who don't have a lot of education, whatever their color, particularly those from the South, they speak with a real kind of just straight, they just have a way of just sort of torching words together in ways that are just brilliant. Now, I mean, you can hear a plumber from New York or Philly talk the same way. When they talk about plumbing fixtures or a carpenter, you know, someone who's not necessarily educated at the Wharton School of Business, the way they just go at language is really, it's just raw poetry for the writer, if you're listening.
John Brown gives this young boy a nickname, Onion. Are you big on nicknames? I mean,
man. When I was growing up, I used to know a kid named Onion.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, he stole my bike, in fact. Yeah, I used to cut Onion, Pig, Beanie, you know,
right.
Junior, all kind of, you know, Buttonhead.
What did they call you?
Well, at camp they called me Cochise, and in college they called me Brittles, and now even now they call me, musicians call me Cuddy.
Cuddy. Now, what's Brittles about?
I went to Europe with a band out of Wilmington, Delaware, when I was in high school, called the American Youth Jazz Band and Chorus, and the trumpet player started calling me Mick Brittles. And then it just became Brittles.
And Cuddy now?
Cuddy became, I used to work with a singer from Philly named Michelle Farrell, who started calling me Cuddy. And she introduced me to all these people from New York, these musicians, and they started calling me Cuddy. Mm. And some of them still call me Cuddy. I'm a man of many names.
Clearly. I mean, John Brown is so much central to the story. And, you know, some people think he's a terrorist. Even to this day, some people think he's, the freedom fighter. Can't decide if he's just a complete fanatic. Is he a good person? Is he a bad person? How much research did you do? And how important was it to research John Brown?
Oh, I mean, I must have read at least 30 books on him.
Really?
And I only used about 10% of what I got, you know, came up with. He was, I guess you could call him a terrorist. I mean, you can call anybody anything. People thought he was nuts because he was this white man who decided that blacks were equal to him. And he called blacks Mr. and Mrs. Yeah. and so forth. And he was deeply religious. I think this book really is a book about faith, ultimately. Because Onion is someone who doesn't believe in God and at the end of the day does. John Brown was, identity is the thing that powers all of us in the morning. It gets us out of bed and gets us moving. And so John Brown just decided that he had heard God's voice and that he wanted to end slavery and no one was listening. And he decided to, pervert the proverbial, I'll take matters into my own hands. But he had a lot of help, you know. Thousands of abolitionists sent him money and weapons and supplied him. People from Philly and Boston and New York. He went to Harper's Ferry and got into trouble there after it was over. America went into a state of absolute panic, and a lot of people had to cut out. A lot of people, you know, sent him money and who were anti-slave abolitionists. They had to get busy. Frederick Douglass suddenly got busy in Europe. I mean, because there was a lot of dissension. Mm-hmm. I mean, John Brown really started, in my opinion, really started the Civil War, because there were only two big anti-slave incidents that really shocked and frightened America, and that was Nat Turner's Rebellion and then John Brown's attempt to take over Harper's Ferry. Mm. And people thought he was crazy.
Did you go to Harper's Ferry? Did you go there?
Oh, several times. I mean,
sort of see what it looked like?
Oh, they should have a cot with my name on it over there.
Really?
Yeah, I was there quite a bit.
Einen calls John Brown the old man. He says, that was one thing. The old man done the same to me. He reckoned every colored wanted to fight for his freedom. It never occurred to him that they would feel any other way. That in a sense, for some slaves, John Brown had wanted their freedom more than they did.
Well, for some slaves, John Brown was willing to fight for their freedom. And those slaves were not willing to fight for their freedom. They were willing to run for it. But to turn and fight was a whole different story. And so I think he underestimated blacks' desire to turn around and fight whites as opposed to their desire to just get free and get clear.
To run for it. Or
right, yeah, to run.
Escape.
Yeah.
But Onion does complain, at least early on, he complains, you know, when I was a slave, I was well fed, I wasn't cold. Here I am, you know, running around Kansas with this John Brown guy, and I'm hungry and I'm cold.
Well, that's that. John Brown never had money. He was always broke. He was always borrowed. He died in debt. He was a failed businessman. He had several businesses that failed. He couldn't manage money. I mean, I know a lot of people like that, you know, but they're not John Brown. But the absurdity, slavery created all kinds of absurd realities. It created farms, for example, where the farmers were dependent on their, say, two or three slaves and didn't dream of selling them because not only did they know them all their lives, but if one of them decided to abscond, they would lose the farm. The complex web of relationships that existed during slavery is something that most people don't understand. And John Brown walked into the middle of it basically with 2 7-shooters and a broadsword and just started hacking away at it. So he cut through a lot of he was just taking people's arteries and ripping them out. I mean, not in a physical sense, but in a mental, spiritual kind of way, because it would be, if I were to go outside and steal your car because I don't like global warming, I suppose you could say I'm right. But on the other hand, you know, you paid for that car.
Right.
And so
right.
John Brown, he just was completely outside the rules of everyone's purview, of everyone's perspective. And yes, Onion was hungry quite a bit with John Brown because John Brown never had a lot of dough.
Did Onion's opinion of John Brown reflect yours? Because early on, he thinks he's kind of a, you know, weird, strange, wacko guy. His cheese had slid off his biscuit, I think, to use Onion's words. And then by the end of the book, he's a man whose mission weren't no lunacy.
Well, I always thought of John Brown as a hero, but I didn't really understand what a hero was. Now I understand what a hero is. So I liked him because he did something good. I liked him like I like Abraham Lincoln or Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. I mean, I like these people, but I don't know. You know, you ask me what they did, I say, well, you know, Lincoln freed the slaves, you know. So, I came to love him and admire him. And I've even prayed for him at night, you know, because I know somewhere in America that he has family that, you know, his family was devastated after Harper's Ferry. They were treated terribly. Black folks loved John Brown and his family, and a lot of white Americans who were abolitionists did, but a lot of people just hated him. And they had a very difficult time after he died. So, and they're walking around among us. There's somebody in the world here in America who has a lineage to this, who I believe is a great man. It's really cool to think about. You know?
At one point in the novel, Onion sees John Brown, I guess, with his kids or with children, and he sees this really soft, sweet, fatherly figure.
Well, John Brown loved children. I mean, John Brown was a true Christian, in my opinion. Now, if you read the books about him, evenly divided, more, some would say he was just a wacko terrorist, and others, and more increasingly, the newer ones see him kind of more as what I think he really was. But he loved children, and he had 22, 12 of whom survived, and he was very close to his children. And two of his children died with him when during the Harper's Ferry attack. And he was very kind to animals. He was a fascinating man. My take on him is that all of us who are interested in politics, and I'm not, but those who are interested in politics tend to personalize, personal opinion only is my personal opinion. They personalize their politics. So their politics becomes an extension of their personal smoke and puff and potato chips and whatever else they got swirling on inside them. John Brown was no different. He had a lot of ambiguity about things. He was a terrible businessman. He trusted the wrong people. He felt that society was falling apart. But when he decided that slaves were equal to white folks, He just became consumed with the idea, and like everything he did, he just did it 100% all the way. And it became a kind of political movement, but he didn't mean it to be that way. And I think that's kind of puts him in the same league as a lot of people who become heroic and controversial.
He captured Harper's Ferry with his 19 men so true. He frightened old Virginia till she trembled through and through.
That was a portion of Marty's 2013 interview with author and musician James McBride about his novel, A Good Lord Bird. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Liz Fiedler, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.
Well, he's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the...